Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for David Inge. Our producers, Harriet Williamson and Travis Stanzel, and Henry Frayne is at the controls. Glad you are listening. During this hour, Focus 580, we'll talk about the work of the National Science Foundation in addressing science, education, and action on the environment. Our guest is Margaret Leinen, Assistant Director for Geosciences at the National Science Foundation. Dr. Leinen is responsible for coordinating environmental science, engineering, and education programs within the National Science Foundation and for environmental cooperation and collaborations between NSF and other federal agencies. Before coming to NSF, Dr. Leinen was Dean of the Graduate School of Oceanography and Vice Provost for Marine and Environmental Programs at the University of Rhode Island, considered one of the top institutions for marine studies. She's also a well-known researcher in paleo-oceanography and paleoclimatology. She is past president of the Oceanographic Society and has served on a number of prestigious scientific boards and councils, including the Board on Global Change of the National Research Council, National Academy of Sciences. And she is a graduate of the University of Illinois. So she's coming back to her alma mater in many ways. Margaret Leinen will be giving a lecture in the Center for Advanced Studies Millicom series today at 4 o'clock on the third floor of the Levis Faculty Center, 919 West Illinois in Urbana. And that is free and open to the public if you'd like to attend. Her lecture is entitled Understanding Complex Environmental Systems, an Exploration of NSF's Vision for the Decade. And it is co-sponsored by a long list of University of Illinois departments and organizations. We'll talk about the work of the NSF in addressing environmental issues and education during this hour with Margaret Leinen. And as we do so, we invite you into the conversation. All you have to do is call us, the number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us. That is 800-222-9455 anytime during our conversation. Margaret Leinen, thanks for being here.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's delightful to be back. I am an alum. I did my undergraduate work here at University of Illinois in the Department of Geology.
Right.
And I also lived here and worked at the Illinois Geological Survey for a couple of years after that. My son was born here. He's a native of Champaign, but it's been about 15 years since I was back, and it's amazing to see all of the change in the area. The Quad, of course, looks very much the same,
yeah.
But once you get outside of that, amazing changes.
Well, I hope your visit is a very pleasant one. Your Millicom lecture is premised on the question, how do we solve tomorrow's environmental problems today? We like small questions like that on this program. How well do we know what tomorrow's environmental problems will be?
I think that we don't know the very specific details of the problems, but we do know what the large overarching questions will be. I think that the 21st century story of the environment is human impact on the environment. There is no place that has not been affected by human activities. And even if it's a very pristine, remote location, the atmosphere over it has been profoundly impacted by our use of fossil fuels. We've changed the chemistry of the atmosphere for a very long time to come. So understanding that the environment is no longer sort of a, you know, pristine concept, that we are part of the environment, we're the strongest agent of change in the environment, and that our ability to understand how we interact with the environment and what happens as a result of that is the issue of the 21st century. There's no going back.
You've talked about the coming observations revolution, meaning that we are, I suppose, able to measure and put sensors and get a lot of numbers about things. Is that essentially what that means? So that we can understand how we're affecting things and how other things affect other things and how that all essentially feeds back into what is a very complex system.
Well, the observations revolution is not just about the fact that we go out and put a lot of things in the environment and observe them, but it's really a revolution in the style of observing, and it's being made possible by the information technology revolution. So in the same way that many of your listeners probably have a wireless home network and wander around with their laptops, scientists can now do that with the environment. So we can deploy all kinds of gizmos and gadgets and instruments and capabilities and not have to be there monitoring them, adjusting them, and so forth. We can do it remotely. So that means that we have greater reach. In addition, we have some incredible capabilities that are coming online as a result of high bandwidth communication. And not so much in the sense of laying cables around the country, but in some areas that we've never been able to look at for long periods of time. Under the ocean, under the ice, in Antarctica. The reason that those are very important is that we know now that the polar regions are really the bellwether of large-scale climate change, and yet they're very, very difficult to work in. While we'd all like to go up and, you know, perhaps watch a polar bear or two for a short time, we don't want to go up there and sit for 6 months for long enough to do a lot of complex measurements. In many areas of the ocean, it's very uncomfortable to be there. You know, it's
right.
I've been through a couple of hurricanes at sea, and it's no fun. And
you've actually been down on Alvin a couple times in the submersible.
I have been down in Alvin several times. And those are they're very difficult regions to study. And so by laying fiber optic cable on the seafloor under the ice and attaching sensors to it, we can pass large quantities of information back to land. Mm-hmm. So the revolution is in what we're capable of for observing. And what I like to say is that we are about to embark on observations which are at the spatial and temporal scales that matter, i.e., those that are appropriate for these huge, huge environmental problems.
When I started on this job about 17 years ago, global warming was just starting to be uttered by various people studying climate change. I mean, literally, it was not the big subject that it is now. And I think there has been a paradigm shift in people's understanding of our impact on the atmosphere, as you alluded to just a little bit ago. With this situation you're describing, where we are about to understand the large-scale things in much finer detail and understand how those things fit together, are we also going – is there another paradigm shift coming in our understanding of essentially what, you know, our impact has been and what perhaps we could do about it?
Yes, I think that the big shift is that we're beginning to understand that global warming, per se, is not the only issue. John Muir once said that once we start picking apart the environment, we find that every piece of it is hitched to every other piece. And we're beginning to find that what we thought were very proximal or immediate impacts are actually related to much more far-reaching impacts. So it's that indirect chain of events. For example, there's been research lately that has suggested that our removal of fish, top predators, from the ocean is really intimately connected through a long chain of relationships to some of the coastal pollution and harmful algal blooms that we see around. Now, that's a speculation at this point. There's some very tantalizing evidence. It's not proven. But just the idea that by removing fish so that we can eat them, that we would have an impact on something as far removed as harmful algal blooms is a very revolutionary idea.
Mm-hmm. And how do you get at those sorts of relationships? What, you know, I imagine there are any number of similar sort of you know, places where things like that, one thing happens and down the chain something else happens. How do you begin to understand that?
Well, I think there are three components of that. First, we have been enormously successful in science over the last 50 years by taking things apart and looking at small bits and pieces of them. And there is absolutely no criticism implied in that. We had to do it. We had to understand how things worked at a separate level or a small level before we could start putting things together. So the first piece is that scientists are now embarked on much more interdisciplinary studies to try to put the pieces together. So that's the first element. The second element is understanding that we have to make observations that may be regional as well as local. And the third is that these are processes which are evolving over time. So we have to continue to make those observations for sometimes a decade, 2 decades, before we can see what's actually happening.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the need for interdisciplinary cooperation, interdisciplinary science. Has that been one of the barriers maybe to understanding the big picture, that people have become so specialized and very, very knowledgeable within their narrow field, but they essentially collaborate with people in their field and not outside it so much?
It could be a barrier in the future. If we allow it to be.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, as I said, we're just in the beginning stages of saying that we have a different approach to looking at the environment. If science were to say, no, we don't want to do that, we want to stay inside of our individual niches, inside of our silos, inside of our buildings, then it's a barrier.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that we're just at the beginning of the challenge of that. And I think that that's one of the things that we've been very concerned about at the National Science Foundation, and one of the reasons that much of the additional funding that we've gotten from Congress over the last 4 years has gone into programs that are very interdisciplinary. So we are trying to provide opportunities for that change of paradigm to take place. And the community has responded very strongly to those. So I'm very encouraged that scientists are ready. They're willing to take up this challenge.
Mm-hmm. Well, in fact, I wanted to ask you to talk a little bit about the work of the NSF in this regard, because my understanding is you're spearheading really what is a major new initiative to address in a very complex and global way these interactions between, you know, the biosphere and human beings as a part of that, technology, culture, demographics, how this, instead of it necessarily only being a scientific issue, you know, does CO2 warm the atmosphere through a greenhouse effect? It's looking at, well, you know, how does population change or the aging of a particular demographic, you know, culture or populace affect CO2, and how all these things essentially play into a very complicated system.
That's right. And that intersect between people and what we do and how we affect the environment and the physical and biological systems is the heart of this new initiative, which is called Complex Environmental Systems, Synthesis for Earth, Life, and Society. We're all familiar with the idea that we use fossil fuel and that we've been burning fossil fuel and that CO2 concentration has gone up in the atmosphere. I think that one of the things that we're less familiar with is that our social structures and our economic structures have a lot to do with the fact that we use fossil fuel at the rate that we do So our social structures are part of this as well. There's also social science is science too, and economics is a branch of social behavioral economic science, and so those are very much a part of this. We're very interested in how you make decisions in the face of great uncertainty. At present, no one can say exactly how much the Earth might warm as a result of the CO2 increase. We can't say exactly whether there would be more or less precipitation in one or another area. And yet, the people who run our local, state, and federal governments have to make some very difficult decisions about what we're going to do in the future in the face of uncertainty. So one of our areas of research, for example, is how people make decisions in the face of uncertainty. And, of course, we've got lots of models. There's the stock market. There's the decision that you make, not knowing exactly what the weather is going to be. So there's a lot of basis for understanding the elements of making decisions under uncertainty, and how to optimize our ability to make those decisions. Another piece is what we call institutions, and by that I mean, for example, the insurance industry is an institution. It's a social institution. And much of the way that these institutions operate controls our behavior. The insurance industry right now is very concerned about the issue of global change. They're concerned that, for example, that changes in climate might result in more hurricanes striking the U.S. There are big dollars involved in that. They have substantial risk. So as institutions, they're trying to make decisions about what they would do. If, for example, the insurance industry made a decision that they were going to start tripling or quadrupling insurance rates in coastal environments as a result of this, that would reverberate through the system enormously. So we want to understand how institutional behavior affects this as well.
We have a call to talk with. Let's include them in a conversation. Let me just reintroduce our guest. We're talking during this hour of Focus 580 with Margaret Leinen. She's Assistant Director for Geosciences at the National Science Foundation, and she's here to speak in the Millicom Lecture Series about the future of science education and action on the environment. And we're taking your calls. We have one person waiting and would welcome others. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. Our caller, first caller is in Champaign on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yeah, that's close enough. I wanted to ask about the idea that discontinuous change, sort of flood change, whatever you want to call it, tipping point. This is the problem with models. We're all reassured that, you know, the scientific method sort of inexorably moves along at a steady pace. But I guess I'm making a sort of a metaphorical analogy to Thomas Kuhn's paradigm shift and all of that stuff that was popular a while back. And now it seems to be called tipping point. But what I'm, rather than distract with that, but what about a concrete example like global warming? We don't know if it's responsible for the heat wave in Europe, but the weather has been kind of screwy, but there's this some modeling that's done that says that if global warming goes on, the Gulf Stream might change its route, and instead of the Gulf Stream going up and warming England and the whole continent of Europe, it might go lower and consequently cause a cooling, you know, something that's counterintuitive. But it's also the idea that the model is only good as, you know, your inputs and your outputs and the way you configure it. And if you can't predict the, I don't know if I'll quote Rumsfeld here, and the unknowable unknowns or something, but I think you're getting my drift, actually. So, it's hard to be reassured when something like that is possible, that there can be a discontinuous change, and then the models are would be embarrassed by that. Yes. Hello.
Yes.
Yes.
All right. We're pondering the question.
Well, it's a wonderful question. One of the reasons that our initiative is called Complex Environmental Systems is because we mean complex in the mathematical sense, i.e. nonlinear, the potential for abrupt changes. It's not just that the environment is complicated, it's highly nonlinear. And your question goes to the heart of that. There are the specific example that you mentioned with the recent hypothesis that the Gulf Stream could actually take off and go across the ocean at lower latitude and cause cooling is based on an analog situation from several thousand years ago when we saw a very abrupt change of a similar nature. And the reason that I bring it up is that now scientists are very, very well aware of this as they think about their models. And they're approaching the problem in several fashions. First of all, they're studying nonlinear systems, nonlinear behavior in every kind of sense, from the theoretical to the applied sense. And many of the models that are being developed for the global climate system are highly nonlinear themselves. Second, they are studying abrupt climate changes in the past to try to understand how the past can be used as an analog for the future. So this this is also a very, very active area of research. Third, these observing systems that I talked about are being conceptualized in ways to try to look at the variables that scientists think may be very susceptible to change and may be the bellwether of change, abrupt change in the future, so that we would have some things out there to help us see early warning. But in the end, your comment about the models and our ability to predict is absolutely right. And I want to give you an analogy of how I see this whole system. And I'll use a sports analogy. If the University of Illinois fields a basketball team of five players and some well-known rival like Michigan or Indiana fields a team of five players, and you know all of the statistics of those five players, everyone they've ever played, every point they've ever made, everything about them, and you know everything about the teams, and you put the two teams on the court five different times, you will have five different results. That's because basketball is a complex system. And you don't expect the Daily Illini sports page to tell you what the score will be. You expect them to tell you, to give you a context so that you understand what the likely result is, their best analysis of what will happen. And if in the end a particular rookie freshman is having an exceptional night because something went right with their exam in a course and they're very enthusiastic about it, the results may tip. And that's the challenge that scientists have, trying to be forecasters as opposed to exact predictors. And it's a big challenge for us to do, and it's also a big challenge in terms of explaining what we're capable of doing and why it's important to keep giving us the tools that allow us to make the best predictions, even though they're not ever going to be entirely accurate.
Does that get your question? Is the caller still there? I think.
I guess I should say Atskiwawa or something, all right? Well, what bothers me, though, it's not mainly scientists, but there are some scientists, including one who just passed yesterday, Teller, who are incredibly arrogant. I think it's more like technologists now. I think scientists are more chastened by these kind of realities and uncertainty principles and things like that, and discontinuous change, quantum leaps, whatever metaphor you want to use. But we have these technologists, I think, who just think that, you know, you can just push something further. If this is good, then a little more will be better. And it's so linear. I'm heartened to say here that NSF has people that are thinking about the nonlinearities. But the behemoth of transnational industry is, you know, which we all participate in, is not paying as much attention to it as it should, and at least, as you say, the insurance companies are starting to come to a little bit from this. Thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks for the call. I wanted to just follow up, and then we'll get to the next caller, I promise. I know that you have done a great deal of research in the specific field that we sort of alluded to, paleo-oceanography, paleoclimatology, looking at you know, I gather, and what little I know of your research, ocean sediments and sort of looking at what has happened. And I would imagine that if we see a record of an abrupt change, that would be an interesting signal to us that such things, such events can happen. Do we see that in the record?
We definitely see that in the record. At the end of each glacial period has ended with a very abrupt change. So while, for example, it took almost 70,000 years for the ice sheet that covered Illinois about 18,000 years ago to grow to that size, it withered away in about 2,000 or 3,000 years. So that was a rapid change from one regime to the other regime. We see the records of changes like that in sediments because the climate is connected. We also see times in the past that we had very, very rapid change that we think may have happened over a decade. Very abrupt changes in North Atlantic circulation that in part have led to these hypotheses about the Gulf Stream and its impact.
Okay. And a quick follow-up on that. Do we have adequate sampling, or is there so much work yet to be done to really understand whatever episodes we can discover about these periods? I mean, how much more research is there to do, for example, in the ocean to determine the, you know, changes in currents and to get a really good picture?
I think that two things. First, there are large areas of the ocean that have not been sampled very well, and scientists are certainly focused on those. They're also focused on other large bodies of water, like lakes, to understand how those climate changes occur when you're in a continental context. And secondly, they're very interested in these observing systems that would allow them to put that in a better context. And so the connections between scientists who study present-day processes and the past is growing ever closer.
Okay. We have another caller on line number 2 in Urbana. Let's include them. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yeah, good morning. I just had two questions. You were talking about earlier a situation where there might be a large economic impact, and I understand that the human effects on the nitrogen cycle in particular are a touchy area, because the farmers are, of course, using nitrogen all the time, and I understand we've doubled the amount of nitrogen going into the cycle. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, the impact of nitrogen on the environment is profound, and you're absolutely right. We've doubled the amount of nitrogen cycling through the system as a result of fertilizer, and as a result of a couple of other processes that put nitrogen into the air. There's very active program in the U.S. and also internationally on the nitrogen cycle to really start to understand all of the impacts, not just the ones that we all see, like eutrophication of lakes and streams, but the impact that this has on microbial processes in the soils, the impact that it has downstream, and you may have heard, for example, that as a result of all of the fertilizer going down the Mississippi, that there is an area off the mouth of the Mississippi in which phytoplankton have used all of that nitrogen and have used up the oxygen. There's actually, it's called a dead zone. So this has impacts far away from the location that we actually use the nitrogen. So this is being studied both from the standpoint of the nature of the cycle, but also very, very vigorously in areas of agriculture and other processes that use nitrogen, industrial processes that use nitrogen, to see what we can do to improve crop yields without nitrogen, or to use processes that that capture the nitrogen. For example, reestablishing the river buffers, the riparian buffers along the fields that actually use the nitrogen and keep it from going into the streams. All of these are very active areas of research.
Yeah, and I get the impression, though, that agriculture as an industry isn't really that concerned at the moment. I don't know if that's just, you know, just a layman's impression. But and then I also wanted to broach another subject with you, and that's the one that bothers me a lot is the whole thing about with the genetically modified organisms. And you were talking about how you know, tipping points and complex systems, and it seems to me that that in particular with GMOs, you really have you're really in a completely new field of problems that you really have nothing that you can go. You work with, you know, make analogies to. Can you talk a little bit about your attitude toward GMOs and what NSF intends to do about perhaps spelling out what would happen in a dynamic fashion down the line?
I can talk a little bit about it. My own background is not in biology, but of course I work very closely with the Biological Sciences Directorate, and this issue is one that comes up very frequently in looking at environmental systems. You're absolutely right that we must look at GMOs from a holistic standpoint and understand not only what the impact of that I think everybody's concern has been inappropriately focused on what if this GMO gets out there and goes wild or takes over or whatnot. I think that in most instances, that the types of changes that are being proposed and the kinds of trials that have been done are really scientists being very responsible about trying to understand that. However, what we don't understand very well is the context of that in a larger arena. Let's say that we do develop some plants, some crop plants, that can fix nitrogen from the soil so we don't have to put so much nitrogen fertilizer on. What's the longer-term impact of that? Even if that organism doesn't go wild, even if we're able to totally control it, we are still changing we'd be changing the nitrogen cycle associated with that that particular cropping. Yes, we wouldn't be putting nitrogen fertilizer on, but we'd be changing the nitrogen that was fixed from the atmosphere or fixed from the soil. And those two have an effect. Anything that we do on a massive scale has an environmental impact. So those are some of the things that we're trying to encourage people to look at. There are some, I think that we are just beginning to use the fossil record as an analog of what happens with changes like this, because, of course, there are spontaneous mutations that have taken place in the past and have resulted in organisms which have had a very profound effect. And both the issues of mutations and the issues of competition between species and how they tend to regulate the ecosystem are ones in which we believe that it's very, very important for us to provide funding and encourage scientists to do a study.
Quick follow-up on the point of the last caller. In addition to understanding the environmental impact of, for example, a GMO variety that would fix nitrogen, as you mentioned institutional level changes that also play into the complex system. And one of those changes is happening with GMO seed stock essentially is institutional in that, especially in traditional indigenous agricultural areas, the introduction of GMOs changes everything in terms of who is doing the farming, how they're doing it, how they're buying their inputs and outputs, and what the nature of the institutional enterprise is all about. And maybe that has long-term impacts that also feed back into how that affects the environment and the economy.
Absolutely. I haven't talked with anyone at Illinois about this, but last month I visited Iowa State, and they were talking to me about these issues of, in fact, I saw billboards along the highways talking about pigs kill, and they're talking about the runoff from pig farms, or that nitrogen fertilizer kills. And one of the things that they're very concerned about is that since agriculture is now an industry that's very different than it was when I grew up, and we're no longer talking about the individual farmer, that the voter in Iowa, the voters in Iowa are predominantly not farmers, and they aren't, their interests and the things that they're worried about are not totally congruent with the things that the farmers are interested in and worried about. And so there's the potential for a big disconnect between the voters in states where these large agro-industry activities are taking place and the agro-industry itself. And I think that's one of those examples of an institutional thing. It's the individuals who vote, not the companies.
Well, we have another call to talk with, and we're actually, we only have about 10 or 12 minutes left with Margaret Linen. She's Assistant Director for Geosciences at the National Science Foundation. She's overseeing a very large initiative to address science, education, and action on the environment. She's here to talk about it, which she will do at 4 o'clock today at the Levis Faculty Center on the third floor. That is in the Millicom Lecture Series, and that's open to the public. Meanwhile, we have another few minutes left and at least one caller waiting. Next up, a listener in Champaign on line number one. Good morning.
Hello.
Yes.
First, thank you very much for an excellent program. I think this is a wonderful explanation of many things and this a very reasonable approach. My question is, why are we blaming CO2 now for the global warming when we've seen significant shifts such as the mid-15th century and early 19th century in climate long before we created man-made high levels of CO2?
That's a very good question. First of all, I think that I want to use the exact words that are being used by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and that is that that there is evidence, there the preponderance of evidence from the scientific community suggests that the recent increases in temperature are related to, not totally caused by, but are related to the increases in CO2. So as I keep saying, it is a complex environmental system, and there are certainly the potential for many interacting causes. But the international science community has said that a significant part of the increase in temperature is related to CO2. Now, your question about especially the medieval warm period and so forth. We now have records that extend over the last 1,000 years. About 150 years of that is instrumental temperature records. The rest is proxy records from tree rings, from ice cores, and so forth. Importantly, there is about a 60 to 70 year overlap in the proxy record and the instrument record that gives us confidence that the proxy record is calibrated. The proxy record shows and does show the medieval warm period. And it also shows that as of about 30 years ago, the northern hemisphere temperatures exceeded those on average of the medieval warm period, and that now we have substantially exceeded those temperatures. We're way beyond the error that's associated with those proxy measurements. So the scientific community has accepted this result and said that it suggests that we have exceeded the average temperatures of the medieval warm period, which were, of course, natural. They weren't related to CO2 or any other human-induced climate change.
Excellent. I really appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks for the call. You mentioned earlier the Arctic and Antarctic regions as being a sort of bellwether of climate change, or at least a key place to look. I may have misphrased that, but I wanted to ask you to talk a little bit about that.
Yes. The Arctic and the Antarctic are very significant in climate for a number of reasons. First, there are big ice sheets or sea ice in both of them. And of course, the snow and the ice are white and they reflect sunlight back into space. And so they have, decrease the amount of warming of the entire globe. So if they weren't there, we would absorb more radiation. In addition, in the Arctic, the sea ice is covering the ocean, so the Arctic Ocean. And so if the ice weren't there, we would have a much warmer Arctic. And that's very closely related to these issues of North Atlantic circulation, the deep circulation of the oceans. In addition, many, many kinds of studies have shown that that especially the Arctic environment is one that's very, very sensitive to small changes in temperature and to small increases. And it has to do a lot with the fact that things freeze. And so the difference between 31 degrees and 33 degrees in fresh water is profound. Yeah. You have ice or you have water. And because water is so much a part of the environment, the freezing and thawing is a major factor. Another example that is very, very much in the thinking of scientists is the permafrost. There's a lot of evidence in Alaska, for example, that permafrost changes are happening very, very rapidly. The melting of permafrost, the heaving associated with permafrost. Two parts of that. One part is, of course, that it's very disruptive, and people have built structure and infrastructure and whatnot on the basis of having frozen ground to build on. But the second is that also part of the permafrost is frozen methane. And, of course, methane is a greenhouse gas. And so the release of methane from the permafrost would be one of these nonlinear things that would increase the amount of CO2, the amount of greenhouse gas in the atmosphere.
So what is going on in the Arctic and Antarctic? I mean, that begs the question, what do we detect in terms of change?
The Arctic Ocean sea ice is 40% thinner than it was 40 years ago. That was a major discovery of just 2 or 3 years ago. We also have evidence that since 1979, when we first started doing satellite photography of the Arctic, that the permanent sea ice cover is substantially smaller. That is, that it no longer extends all the way to the land, and so the size of the ice sheet, the permanent ice cover of the Arctic, is less, probably about 90%, 87% of what it was in 1979, and we know that it's 40% thinner than 40 years ago.
Well, there's a lot there that we could...
Let me add
one
thing.
Sure, absolutely.
The Arctic has been covered in sea ice for 30 million years. This is not something that we've experienced before, and not something that we've had a lot of experience with even in the recent geologic record.
Okay. Well, we could certainly talk for a long time about that. We only have about 5 minutes left, and there are a whole bunch of topics I want to at least touch on, or at least a couple topics in the time remaining. One is, since we're here at the University of Illinois, which has a major environmental program here, I wanted to talk a little bit about the importance of education in addressing the issues that we're talking about, and how are we doing on that, and how could we do better? What do you see as being the potential for addressing these issues through education?
Well, they're very important. Not only do we need scientists who are trained in disciplines to be able to look at this, and scientists who are willing to go across disciplines, but we need a more literate public. These are very difficult issues. Referring to the first caller who talked about, you know, nonlinearity, and so what are you guys up to with these models that may not be realistic? Unless people can understand nonlinearity, the complexity of the system, and understand how to interpret what they hear from scientists, we're not going to be in a good position to respond to it. So that brings us to the issue of the challenge of this kind of education. We have a lot of experience with training people in disciplines. We don't have a lot of experience with training people to be able to go across disciplines. And what does it take? What kind of tools do they need? What kind of educational style do they need? We certainly don't want to cut them off from knowing specific things about pieces. So that's a real challenge. Second challenge in education is that in most states, environment and geoscience are not taught at all in the grade school and high school level. Our curriculum is so full that we're challenged just to get physics and chemistry and biology in. So we have a population that knows less about this than they used to. A third piece, I think, one that disturbs me very much, is that when you look at the underrepresented groups in the country, we have the poorest participation by underrepresented groups of any science, including physics, including engineering. And there are a wide variety of cultural reasons. This isn't because geoscientists have barred the door. There are a lot of reasons that have to do with the background of people and with what they think is important and relevant. Right now, about 25% of the population is underrepresented groups as defined by the federal government. And in children under 5, it's 45%. In 13 years, that's the entering class of freshmen at the University of Illinois. If they haven't heard of this, if they don't know anything about it, if we haven't made it relevant to them, we're going to be cutting ourselves off from the future generation of scientists.
How do we go about encouraging more women and members of, you know, Latinos, African Americans, et cetera, to engage in this, to care about it, to be interested in it as a career?
To again use a sports metaphor, it has to be a full court press. There is no easy answer. There's no one place that we have to devote our attention. We have to, and NSF is very much engaged in this, we have to provide opportunities for them in informal science through museums and so forth. We have to engage K through 12 education to provide examples of the interest that's out there and the challenging problems that are out there. And children are intrigued by the environment. It's fun. It's outside. You know, it's not sitting in a room with no windows. We need to address the issue of once we have some interest, what are we giving them at the high school level? If we are forcing teachers not to expand their opportunities by saying you've got to teach XYZ, we don't allow them much room. And then finally, at the undergraduate level, if we don't provide them with opportunities to go across disciplines and curriculum, we have difficulty as well. So we have to address all of those levels.
Well, that's a good place to leave it. Since we're out of time, we'll have to do that. But I will mention again that our guest, Margaret Linen, will be speaking today at 4 o'clock on the third floor of the Levis Faculty Center, 919 West Illinois Street in Urbana. This is part of the Center for Advanced Study Millicom Lecture Series, and that is free and open to the public if you'd like to attend. We have successfully scratched the surface of this topic, as we often do. But I want to thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. My pleasure.